Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Car Flag Nation, mount up. Yeah, I said it. It's official. It is time. Get your car flags out, Laker fan. Slap them on your rig. Let's do this. Let's go. And I'm not talking about one flag. I'm not talking about two flags. There better be four or more. One for each window, maybe throw one on the trunk. Throw six of them up on your sled. One for each win during this current streak. Because they have won six in a row. And after last night's win over the Bulls, you've got to be feeling it right now. Feeling it big time. And no, normally a win over the Chicago Bulls is not a reason to party. But when the win comes the way it did last night, go ahead. You have my permission. Party your ass off. Last night did not look like it was going to be a reason to rage. Not when the Lakers were down 19 on the road against a crappy Bulls team. No, not a reason to go or party or rage. It felt like a wasted night, a complete waste of time, theirs and ours. You know, the inevitable letdown after winning the first two games of a road trip. As Frank Vogel, yes, he is still coach. As Frank Vogel said afterwards, Anthony Davis was in foul trouble. LeBron needed a rest. And when the Lakers were down 13 going into the fourth quarter, it looked like they were shutting it down and just going home. However, when Jiminy Cricket was down, did you count him out?
Jiminy Cricket was down. Did you count him out?
While Kyle Kuzma was down, did you count him out? No, this is the comeback, Doug. 6-1. Did you see how they did that last night? Did you see Alex Caruso?
Did you see DeMarco Murray?
This is the game, Doug.
This is the game, Doug.
And the Lakers rose up from the dead. How about Kyle Kuzma? Finally starting to look like Kyle Kuzma. He got hot. Then Dwight Howard came through with a dunk. And then a layup followed by a Quinn Cook three. Suddenly the Lakers had the lead. A 16-0 run in just over 3 minutes. And it wasn't LeBron or AD doing it. It was the bench mob. This is why I'm so hyped up right now about this team. Remember all that noise about how it was going to be a two-man team. And that you can't win a title with two stars and nothing else. That depth or lack thereof was going to be the thing that killed the Lakers. Wrong answer. Not only is their depth not a liability, it's one of their strengths. And that second unit did as much to win that game last night as the first, maybe even more. Because that second unit is led by reigning Jim Rome player of the season, Dwight Howard. And Dwight was huge once again on both ends last night.
Kobe White with Kuzma digging in on defense. Kobe White knocked out of bounds by Dwight Howard. Not tonight.
Man, this dude. Get that out of here. This dude, Dwight Howard, showing up every single night. And then you had LeBron. LeBron went to work.
LeBron with control of it, the strong dribble. Back to the basket. LeBron in the lane. Kicks it. Corner. Post. Got it. Yes, sir.
Making the right basketball play. Then he caps off the night with this lob to Anthony Davis.
Coming up on the 2-minute mark. Anthony Davis to LeBron James. Lob to AD. Throw it down.
Lakers 118, Bulls 112. They have won six straight. They do have the best record in the West. No, check that. They've got the best record in the league. So now it's time to be real. Let's be real for a minute. How many of you saw this coming? How many of you saw any of this coming? I know Laker haters did not see this coming. But even you Laker fans, how many of you saw this coming? How many of you saw Dwight Howard being a force at both ends? How many of you saw the Lakers locking it down defensively this season? How many of you saw JaVale McGee and Quinn Cook chipping in the way they did last night? And there is one other question, which I'll get to in a second. A heavier question. It's going to require some serious self-reflection. Some serious, legitimate, real. But before we get to that, how many of you saw this team winning six in a row after that loss to the LA Clippers and doing it without a fully healthy Kyle Kuzma? Because as any Laker honk will tell you, he's only working his way back and knocking off all the rust from the injury he suffered over the summer. And it's been done with their defense. These guys have turned into a clamps operation overnight. That's the biggest shock of all. Not only that they actually play defense, but right now no team in the league is playing better defense than the Lakers. So again, I ask, how fired up are you, Laker fan? You've got every right to be jacked up. It's the team's first six-game winning streak since 2011. It's a hell of a long time ago. I'll tell you how long ago that was. That team had Kobe, Powell, Lamar, Meta, Bynum, and Luke Walton. Luke Walton was a player, not a coach. Same thing with Derek Fisher. It's been so long since a six-game winning streak that Steve Blake was on that team. That's like the ultimate time warp, right? The guy that many of you have glossed as Steve Blake's dad, Alex Caruso, is coming through now with 7 points, 3 boards, and 2 assists, or steals, I should say, last night. And because on top of all of that, these comebacks against Dallas and Chicago show the Lakers have a grit. They've got a toughness. They're playing with some edge. They're playing with some saltiness, which brings me back to my other point. Old man LeBron. I mentioned this earlier. How many of you saw this coming, and how many of you saw this coming from LeBron? Be real. How many of you had already written this guy off? How many of you had already said it was going to be AD's team, and it was a matter of LeBron playing out the string and deferring to AD every single night? Man, I know a lot of you were thinking that. I heard a lot of you say that. I know a lot of you were saying just that, and I know LeBron heard it too. He heard you talking all last year. He heard you talking all summer long. He heard everybody saying that he was getting too old, that he lost a step, that Kawhi was now the best player in the league. And then he dropped his third straight triple-double last night. First time a Laker's done that since Irv back in 87. He dropped that triple-double, and then he dropped this lava on Twitter. Quote, hashtag washed king. With the shh emoji and a crown. I see you working, King. He heard everybody saying that he was washed, that he was broken down, that he did not have the same drive, the same passion, the same desire for the game anymore. And now look at him. Dude is ramming Crow Sandoz and Humble Pie Chasers down everybody's throat. And he's doing it every single night.
LeBron hit the basketball. Here he goes! All the way! Look out!
Wow.
Spectrum Sportsnet with that. Have some. 17 years in, he's still doing that. 17 years in, and he's going back to back to back with triple-doubles. Go ahead, AD. Tell him. AD said, quote, I'm LeBron James, and I can't do anything anymore except record triple-doubles. And now all you Laker fans better be going triple-double on your car flags. You've got my permission. No, you've got my command. It has not been this good to be a Laker fan in a long time. And yes, I know, small sample, only 7 games. But I've seen enough to know. I've seen enough to say, confidently say, get those freaking flags out and rock the hell out of them because the Lake Show is back. Los Angeles, freaking California, y'all. Life is good for NBA fans right now, right here. Real, real good. Between the Lake Show and the Clips, this is basketball for Nirvana for the city of LA. Clipper fans, Laker fans, LA residents, get your ass up in here. I normally don't want to rep too hard. I'm happy to do so right now. Basketball in LA, Los Angeles, California, y'all. How you like us now? The Memphis head football coach Mike Norvell is my guest. You know, Mike, there's so many guys I could ask you about, but Antonio Gibson had a 50-yard touchdown catch, a 97-yard kickoff return for a TD, a 78-yard touchdown run, all part of a school record of 386 all-purpose yardage. What do you make of the night that he had?
It was incredible, and Antonio's a young man that's having a great year. You know, he's been so very impactful for our team. You know, watching his journey is one that I'm really proud of because the way that he's developed, you know, He was a young man that joined our program from the junior college ranks. You know, last year did some good things for us, but really has trusted the process of his development and maximizing his opportunity. And you know, there's no better time than on a national broadcast. Two ranked teams, playing their Saturday night to have his best game, and he definitely, was a performance for the ages.
Trust the friendly, knowledgeable parts professionals at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Their professionals know what it takes to get the job done right. Professional technicians have counted on O'Reilly Auto Parts for years. Come see for yourself, O'Reilly Auto Parts. Better parts, better prices every day. You know, last year you had Tony Pollard and Daryl Henderson, so you think that there might be a step back, but the fact is you've got weapons, you've got playmakers. But what really impressed me, Mike, was the fact that you had three touchdowns taken off the board. It would have been pretty easy for your guys to give in, maybe even fold after that, but they never did. What's that tell you about your team?
You know, it just continues to showcase the heart and character that we have. And our guys, we pride ourselves on how we respond in every situation. Sometimes you have to respond to success, and then there's times that you have to respond to adversity. And like you mentioned, having those touchdowns, pulled off the board. It truly just came down to the next play, and to go out there and respond at a high level was what was needed. And our guys, they lived up to the challenge.
We're talking Memphis football. Head coach Mike Norvell is my guest. You know, Mike, I think obviously that was a great, great showcase for the program, for the players, for the coaching staff, but also for the city on the whole. As a city, Memphis is a really unique place. It's a special place. What do you know about that city and the community right now that maybe you didn't know when you first arrived?
Well, I was so proud of how our city represented itself, and this town. I mean, not having the, we have the Grizzlies as our pro organization, but the University of Memphis and our athletic programs are vital to the buzz, the excitement, and really the perspective of our city. And to get this opportunity to showcase and to see the support. I mean, there was, you look at 10 years ago. I mean, there weren't a whole lot of people going to Memphis Tiger football games, and what we've been able to grow and just the overall mindset of our community and the support that we're giving, to see that stadium at that moment, it was special. And it is definitely there's electricity about Tiger Athletics, not only the football program but our basketball program and what we're doing, and really all our athletic programs. It's just continuing to grow and progress, and that's what you're seeing in our city as a whole as well.
Mike, as you mentioned, like 10 years ago, there was not a lot of excitement, a lot of buzz about the program. So back in the day, the thinking may have been if you lose a couple of weapons like Pollard and Henderson to the NFL, it may take a season or two to rebuild. Are you at a point right now where you no longer need to concern yourself with that? Is it a matter of just reloading? Have you gotten to that point? And if so, how much pride do you take in that fact?
I think so. I mean, recruiting matters, and we've been able to put together, through my five recruiting, cycles. Four of the five have been the best recruiting classes in school history. We've really been pleased with how we've been able to attract playmakers into the program, develop them, and then put them in a position to be showcased. And I'm really pleased with where the culture of our program is. Just the mindset when you lose great players, to the NFL or to injury or to graduation. I mean, it provides a new opportunity, and that's something that our guys have really worked hard to do, year round, to develop themselves, to push in all aspects of their life, academically, socially, and then we know what's going to show up on the football field. And these guys are definitely making the most of the opportunities that are in front of them.
Now, Mike, you know the deal. When you've had the success that you've had at Memphis, your name is going to come up for other jobs. How are you approaching that? How do you handle that? For instance, do you owe it to yourself to at least answer the phone when it rings, or are you handling it in a different manner?
You approach every day. You go. It's a compliment that when people are talking about your program, your coaches. When there's a positive message and perspective about what we're doing. But at the end of the day, our total focus is on what we're doing here, and every day trying to get better. That's been my approach to it in years past when the same things have occurred. And at the end of the day, I'm so excited about the opportunity I have to lead this program and develop the guys that we have, and we got big things in front of us, and so that is all where our focus is at.
And then finally, Mike, what about this week? You've got the week off before you're back at it against Houston next weekend. How do you go about approaching the bye week? Is it all about rest and recovery for the players?
It's all about improvement, and that's the thing. We're halfway through it. You just got to practice field a little while ago, and we've had two great days, and we've went good on good with our work. You know, with the ones on ones, twos on twos, trying to simulate as much of the speed as we can, and we'll give them a little rest. We're going to give them Friday and Saturday off to kind of recover. But at the end of the day, the message doesn't change. It's all about being the best version of ourselves today, continuing to improve on our journey, and we know we've got a big challenge coming up in Houston there next week. So our kids have brought the right approach, and I like where their mindset is.
Memphis is 8-1. They're number 19 in the AP and the coaches poll, and they've got another big one. Houston on November 16th. Mike Norvell is the head coach of Memphis in his fourth season. Mike, great to have you back. Congrats on that win, and I'll look forward to doing it again soon.
Most definitely. Thanks so very much, and you have a great day.
Are you craving some protein after a good workout? Do not make a shake or eat a bar. Instead, reach for a bag of beef jerky from Old Trapper. Old Trapper beef jerky is tasty and it's tender, and it's made with real strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a wood fire, and it goes wherever you go, to the game, to the gym, to the beach, anywhere. Look for Old Trapper in the Clearview bag. You can see the quality you're buying, and look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, ask for it by name, because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? So Monday there was a report that the LA Chargers might possibly be becoming the London Chargers, not as in London, California, that place near Visalia that's so small it's not even a town. No, I mean the London, London, England Chargers, as in moving to another country. Listen, I mean, if you want to think about whether or not that makes sense, it's not that far-fetched. There are a lot of reasons why that might be a good alternative. In fact, there were 83,000 reasons at Wembley on Sunday for the Jags-Texans game. And given the fact that the fans in England continue to show up for all these random games that never seem to feature two winning teams, imagine what that fan base might be like for a team that's actually good, that's always there. As an example, according to reports, more than 2 million tickets have been sold over the past 13 years for games in London. So clearly, there's a market there. There's a fan base there. Eventually, there is going to be an NFL team there. We know that. So why not be that team? If you're the Chargers, forget sharing a stadium and a city with the Rams. The Chargers would have an entire stadium, an entire country, hell, an entire continent to themselves. They wouldn't have to compete with the likes of the Rams, the Lakers, the Clippers, the Dodgers, the Angels, the Galaxy, LAFC, the Kings, the Ducks, the Trojans, the Bruins, the Beach, the Mountains, etc., etc. Like, if you wanted American football in London, you'd be the only show in town. And instead of being in a tricky spot a few miles up from a pissed off fan base, you'd be in a spot where everybody loved you. Everybody was happy to see you. So that's where that report came from. And it came out on Monday. And then by Tuesday, the Chargers had their response. And they released it in a couple of different ways. First, there was the tweet. A tweet that had no words, no caption, no emojis, just a clip. Roll it.
You know what? I'm not leaving. I'm not leaving.
I'm not f***ing leaving! The show goes on! This is my home. They're gonna need a fucking wrecking ball to take me out of here. They're gonna need to send in the National Guard or fucking SWAT team, because I ain't going nowhere.
Actually, an awesome clip. An awesome clip from Wolf of Wall Street. If you've seen that movie, you knew that. If not, that's an awesome clip. And if that was not direct enough, and if that was not profane enough, well, here comes Chargers owner Dean Spanos with his thoughts on the report that his team is on its way to London. Spanos said, quote,
I know there's been a lot of crap going around the last 24 hours about this London thing, and I just want to give you a quote from me, okay? It's total okay? We're not going to London. We're not going anywhere. We're playing in Los Angeles. This is our home, and this is where we're planning to be for a long time, okay. Period. Okay? And if you want me to say it again, I'll say it again. That story. Okay? Thank you.
You know what, Dean? I would like you to say it again. Go ahead, Dean. Say it again.
I know there's been a lot of crap going around the last 24 hours about this London thing. And I just want to give you a quote from me, okay? It's total okay? We're not going to London. We're not going anywhere. We're playing in Los Angeles. This is our home, and this is where we're planning to be for a long time, period. Okay? And if you want me to say it again, I'll say it again. That story, okay? Thank you.
Okay. No, thank you. Keep saying it, man. That was so good. Hell yes. That's exactly the kind of statement that I'd love to read from a team. Don't come in here with that weak sauce statement about how there is no substance whatsoever to this report. I'll tell you what I'm not interested in. Heavily processed, scripted language about how no consideration has been given to the Chargers playing anywhere other than Los Angeles at the new stadium in Hollywood Park next season and beyond. Which is exactly what the league did. With their statement about the report. Nobody wants that. Give it to us straight. Give me F-bombs. Give me bull bleeps. Give it everything you've got. Let me know how you feel. That's awesome. That soccer stadium in Carson should be packed for their next home game. And yes, I am well aware of what happened to the Wolf of Wall Street. I know homeboy nearly killed himself with Quaaludes and cocaine. And that he spent nearly 2 years in prison for securities fraud. I know this. I know that if you really want to drill down on it, it is kind of weird, I guess, to choose Jordan Belfort to be a quasi-spokesperson for your organization. But they're not actually using or endorsing that guy. They're using the scene to make a point. Point being, the team ain't bleeping moving to London. And yes, I also know it's kind of ironic that the Chargers are making a statement about never moving, considering they moved only a couple of years ago. And yes, I also know there are plenty of fans in San Diego who are thinking, where the hell was that tweet a couple of years back? Where the hell was Dean Spanos saying a couple of years back, we're not bleeping moving to LA, it's bull bleep. San Diego fan, I feel you. I do. And I'm not going to tell you that you're wrong to feel that way. And if you want to get loose about that, you are welcome to do so. But at the same time, I got to be real. I like how the Chargers handled that report. On Twitter and with their owner coming out the way he did. Again, I don't need some safe, sanitized, watered-down version of things. I want F-bombs. I want more F-bombs in statements about teams. I want more F-bombs from owners. Because while that report was about whether the Chargers, and this is the thing now, while the report was about whether or not they were going to London, moving to London, we're talking about a very different subtext. The report beneath the report. The suggestion underneath all of it was that the Chargers are already little brother.
Brother.
That this team is not going to support two teams, this town. That the Bolts are already the odd man out. That the house and the town already belong to the Rams. So this wasn't really about the Chargers moving to London. It was about whether or not they've already been run out of town. A town that they haven't even lived in yet. And if you get called out like that, and they were, you better let the hands go. You better let the F-bombs fly. And the Chargers did exactly that. So if you want to be in Los Angeles and you want to fight for the market and for the fans in this city, you better be prepared to fight and go. And suggesting that you don't want that and you're already looking for a way out is a reason to go. The message being, if you're looking to take us out, you better knock us the hell out. Listen, if the league wants to put a team in London, great. But the Chargers are saying, it ain't going to be us. We've already planted our flag. It's here in L.A., Yeah, we'll see whether or not they win the battle for L.A. We'll see whether or not this town is big enough for two teams. In the meantime, I like the reaction. I like what it represents. I like the attitude. I like an owner F-bombing. Hey, Dean, I will say this, though. You weren't really clear enough in the way you answered that. Is your team going to London or not? Dean, is the story true?
It's total okay? We're not going to London. We're not going anywhere. We're playing in Los Angeles. This is our home, and this is where we're planning to be for a long time.
Hey, Dean, are you going anywheres?
We're not going anywhere.
Let me tell you something. It's a fine moment for him. It's a good moment for him. A strong moment for him. But let me ask you this, though, Dean, to be fair. I'm just being reals. I'm being reals with you. You staying here is, like, just temporary, right? I mean, ultimately, you will bounce, right?
This is where we're planning to be for a long time.
Look at that, man. I like the way they handled that. I do. I like the way he handled that. I like the way they handle that. But just answer this for me, Dean, really quickly. I'm running out of time. Is the story true or not, D?
I'll say it again. That story. Okay?
Man, he's pissed. He is pissed, and I like it. I like the way they handled it online, and I like the way he handled it offline. But are you going or not, Dean? Just answer the question.
Again. That story. Okay.
Good job, Dean.
Thank you.
John Dornbos is my guest. John, good to have you back on. How are you?
Hey, Rockstar. Thank you for having me.
Oh, man. So, John, you and I spoke back in 2016 about your incredible story, but there's a lot to catch up on. First off, I got to ask you, how does it feel to add published author and Amazon bestseller to your list of accomplishments?
Ridiculous, because let's be honest, I had not one English teacher my entire life that thought, A, I would be published, and B, it would be a bestseller. So just breaking odds, baby. Just breaking odds.
All right, so you're breaking odds. And anybody listening right now, John, I think knows your story, and they heard it back in 2016. But for those who do not know this, it's important to reset it, and it's something you talk about and something you write about, but I still want to be really sensitive in how we deal with this. But when you were 12 years old, your father killed your mother. I cannot begin to imagine what that must have been like. When you share that story now and you write about this in the book, what types of things do you talk about?
Well, so for me, life came full circle, and I had years of therapy, and during that time, I was learning what forgiveness was and what it meant to me. And so my wife and I, we had our first daughter 5 months ago, and right before my daughter was born, I realized it was time for my life to come full circle and sit down with my dad for the first time in 26 years and tell him that I forgive you. And what I was trying to do is find motivation that would make me a better father, a better husband. And I truly believe that if we can take motivation from defeat, failure, and from the worst things that happen to us, then I think we're going to make this world a better place. So when people read my book, I hope that they take away a few things that maybe help them find clarity, help them find forgiveness, get rid of bitterness, and just live happy.
John Dornbos joining us. You know, there's a lot to unpack in that, and I want to get into it. The book is called Life is Magic. It's out right now, and I do want to talk about that meeting you had with your father. But as you go back at that time, magic, of course, played a role in helping you cope back at that time. How so? Why was that so important?
So I got into magic when I lost my parents. And what it was is, and I didn't realize it till later in life, but when I would sit down and shuffle cards, I would get lost, and the chatter of the world would disappear, and I was just a kid. And so for me, it was my time to just be a kid, and my brain would process things, right? So I found 52 buddies in a deck of cards that they never lie to me, and they always tell me what I'm wrong. And to this day, when I'm looking for that peace in the world, I sit down at a table, and I just listen to the cards riffle and shuffle, and it just takes me away.
John Dornbos joining us. Also, John, there is a spot in Huntington Beach that also plays a role in all of this because it's a place where you would go to think about and talk to your mom. What were those moments like?
So when my mom passed, we opened her jewelry box, and she had three necklaces that she was going to give us kids when we turned 18. But obviously, she passed before I turned 18, so they gave me that necklace. Lo and behold, I went to Huntington Beach, California. It fell off in the ocean. I was devastated. And that was probably the first time that I realized I can change the story and find some positivity in that. And I told myself that my mom wanted to go around the world, and that necklace was never meant for me to wear. And instead, a whale took it over to Hawaii, and then a turtle took it to Australia, and then she went to Thailand and the Philippines. So for me, anytime I would sit at the ocean and anytime I see the ocean, now I know that my mom's been there and done that, and I can talk to her.
John Dornbos joining us. He's got a brand new book. It's called Life is Magic. It's out right now. At one point when you were in that spot, you said, John, quote, I want more in this life. I don't want to be somebody who lives in circumstance. I want to be a person of vision, end quote. I mean, that's pretty profound. What do you remember about that time, and what were you feeling then?
So I went back to the beach in my 20s. I felt like it was time for me to move on, and it was time for me to get rid of this bitterness and hate and anger of my dad murdering my mom. And so I looked up in the sky and I said, "Hey, Mom, it's time that I forgive Dad within myself and find clarity." But there was a part of me that felt like my mom was going to be upset and that it was about picking sides. And I think that was the moment that I started to learn that forgiveness isn't about picking sides. It's not about winning, losing. It's not about I'm okay with what you did, I agree with what you did, or evening the score. I learned that forgiveness for me is just coming to terms with my reality, being okay with my past, being okay with where I am in this world, and just letting go of bitterness. And so I looked up in the sky, and that was kind of the first time that I felt like I wanted to forgive my dad in order to be the man that my mom always wanted me to be and do good things in this world.
John Dornbos joining us. He played 14 years in the NFL. And then, John, speaking of football, we talked about your football career back in 2016 and the incredible circumstances surrounding that. But then in 2017, you were traded to New Orleans. During a physical, the doctors discovered something. What was it, and what was that moment like when you were told that news?
Yeah, so at the time, I'm 37 years old. I just signed a 3-year extension for more money than I'd ever made. I played a game with the New Orleans Saints, and sure enough, I went and took my physical. And they discovered I had a severely leaky valve, so I had blood leaking back into my heart, as well as an aneurysm in the aorta that leaves the heart. So there's basically a vein that leaves your heart. It should be about the size of a dime or a nickel, and mine was the size of a Coke can. If that thing pops like a water balloon, you die instantly. And so my aneurysm got way too big. My heart got too big. Blood was leaking everywhere. And they basically said, you're never playing football ever again, and you're going to be in emergency open heart surgery probably in the next 48 hours. And had you played this Monday night and got hit in the chest, you had a far greater chance of dying than living.
So when you hear news like that, I mean, you're a professional athlete, you play a very violent game, you're used to getting hurt, you understand that, you take care of it, you get surgery, you get back to work. This is not that in any way. When you were told that news, what was that like? How did you process that?
Well, all of a sudden, my career was over. My life had been turned upside down. I was out over $3 million. And you're just trying to process, and then you become a victim, right? You start getting bitter. You start getting angry. You're like, wait, this is not how my career's going to end. I had worked so hard, made a couple Pro Bowls. This isn't how, right? I've worked too hard for this. And then sure enough, you got to snap out of it, and you got to tell yourself a story, just like I did when I lost my necklace, in order to find peace in this situation and realize that life happens, and it happened to me, and it doesn't matter whether I agree or not. And so I basically was like, man, you know, my mom's best friend sang Wind Beneath My Wings at her funeral. And I remember I had the wind beneath my wings when I was an Eagle for so long. And when I found out the news, a guy named Drew Brees walked by, and I saw his last name, Brees. So the story I told myself is I had to step out of the wind and catch a breeze. And for whatever reason, I was traded to New Orleans to have my life saved by a saint. And so now it was about reevaluating my life and being happy that I was alive and being okay with whatever life was going to have in store for me. But me going to New Orleans wasn't about me playing football. It was about saving my life.
John Dornbos joining us. So it's about having your life saved by a saint, but then at the same time, pragmatically, I guess, you're doing your homework on the right doctor, and this one name keeps coming up. You call this guy, and you find out not only is he an Eagles fan, but the doctor says to you, and I want to read the quote, "I can't tell you how excited I am that you called me. I'm just going to lay it out there for you. There's nobody better than me at this. I'm going to tell you right now, if you were just having a valve replacement, yeah, there are a handful of surgeons in America that you could go to and you'd be fine. But if you want a valve replacement and an aneurysm fix, get your ass on a plane, come to Philly, let me save your life," end quote. First of all, John, who was the doctor, and what do you remember about that call?
So we had called all these surgeons around the world, and every one of them had been taught by this guy named Joseph Bavaria at University of Penn. And so sure enough, back in Philadelphia, we call him, we get him on the phone, and that literally was like verbatim exactly what he said. And, you know, my wife and I just looked at each other, and we just remember the swag, right? Get your ass on a plane and let me save your life. And he said, I'm an artist, I'm eloquent. The reality is we're going to have a lot of information, but until we go in there, you never know what's going to happen. So if anybody's in there that you want it to be me. So my wife and I got on the plane, we headed to Philly. And fortunately for me, I was able to get in with the number one surgeon in the world for the exact surgery that I needed. And it was just amazing.
John Dornbos joining us. He's got a new book. It's called Life is Magic. The book is out right now. The thing is, John, as much confidence, as much swag as that surgeon had, open heart surgery is still one of the scariest things ever. What was the night before the surgery like? And then what do you remember about the morning of the surgery and the moment when you were wheeled away from your wife?
Oh, my God. You're going to get me choked up. So you're kind of in this stage of denial, and it becomes you become like an athlete, and there's a process, and you're preparing for the moment, right? But the magnitude and the emotion of it doesn't set in until it happens. And so we prepared, we got ourselves in a position to be successful, just like you do as an athlete. And then the morning of, I'll never forget when I got wheeled out and they told my wife, this is as far as you can come. And I turned the corner and it was the moment that I didn't see my wife. And that's when it all hit me. And then the anesthesiologist came up to me and she said, hey, I'm going to put a mask on you. You're going to go to sleep. So tell me what island you want to go to and I'm going to send you there and you're going to wake up and be good to go. And in that moment, I literally saw myself dipping my wife on the beach in Mexico when we got married. And I said, hey, take me back to my wedding day because it was the best day of my life. And I never tell my wife goodbye. I always tell her I'll kiss you soon. So sure enough, the surgery was supposed to be 4 or 5 hours. It ended up being close to 11. And the anesthesiologist came out about 8, 9, 10 hours into it, out there just wanting to know what's going on. And just like in a movie, she walked up and said, everything's good. It's going to take us about an hour and a half to sew him back up. And by the way, right before your husband went under, he wanted me to tell you that he'll kiss you soon. And my wife lost it. And just, that was an emotional time.
John, I think everybody listening right now is getting choked up on that. What do you remember? And again, just so they're clear on this, it was supposed to be 4 hours. It lasted more than 10. The doctor said that your sternum was the hardest he'd ever had to crack. He literally was standing on a stool to get leverage. What do you remember about waking up? Do you?
You know, I remember my wife saying, honey, you have to squeeze my hand. Honey, you have to squeeze my hand. And I barely squeezed it. And then I remember them putting ice chips on my lip, and ice chips have never tasted so good. And then I remember my wife saying, honey, you have to move your feet. You have to move your feet. And so sure enough, I would move my toes. And I was going in and out, in and out. But basically, the nurses were telling her, as you come out of the anesthesia and as you come out of the ICU, there's checklists that your husband has to do in order to wake up to make sure that everything's working. Have him squeeze your finger, have him move his toes, and just get any response you can. And so when those responses happen, I just remember hearing my wife sigh, and then I would just fall back asleep. And then I'd wake up, move your toes, and I'd move my toes, and then I'd hear, and I'd feel my wife's head just kind of hit my shoulder and just sigh, and then I'd fall back asleep.
John Dornbos joining us. He's got a book out, and the book is brand new. You want to get this. You know, John, something else, I have to skip ahead. There's so much. I wish I can cover this whole thing, but there's so much more. You mentioned your daughter. You have a five-month-old daughter. What is she like, and what's that experience been like?
It's the most amazing thing in the world, and I've never had such joy, and I've never had such accountability that now I realize that my daughter is looking up to me. And as a man in today's world who's been suffered and been a part of a house with domestic violence that changed our life forever, you know, I think as men, we need to take responsibility and treat people right and show our kids an example and learn how to get an outlet for our anger and our rage. And so my daughter's looking up to me and she's seeing how I treat her mom and she's seeing how I treat people. And I realize that that's what she's going to come to expect in any relationship she has. So it's a new sense of me dating my wife. It's a new sense of me dating my daughter. And I love everything about being a dad. And I can't wait to be the dad that I never had.
Late in the book, John, you write that recovery is a funny thing. There isn't any one moment when you realize when you're back to being you. Can you lay that out for me? What do you mean by that?
So open heart surgery has a lot of side effects, and I was on 21 pills. And so you have different stages of depression, anger. You have different. You get really, really frustrated and annoyed, and you're trying to come back to you. And then you reach this time where all of a sudden it's 6 or 7 months later, you're starting to get off the meds. And you get really frustrated at things that normally you wouldn't, and you realize it, but you can't snap out of it. And so it's just this weird dynamic of kind of rediscovering who you are. And look, you got all these, you know, I had cadavers in me, I had foreign tissue in me, so your hormones are just going crazy, your body's trying to figure out what's going on. So you have these emotional and mood swings. And, you know, I don't know if I'll ever be the same, but every day is a struggle to get back to who I was, to get back to that path of happiness. And you know, that's why I'm proud of this book, is that if people are struggling with something or they need closure or they need forgiveness or they're bitter at something, I really think that there's things in this book that they'll read that might help them find just that.
I'm going to ask you about closure in one moment. There is one point, though, where you went to see Mike Tyson's one-man show of all
Amazing.
Things. Yeah. So what was that experience like? What kind of an impact did that have on you?
So I'm a performer and I love it. And you get, you know, whether it's Carrot Top or Garth Brooks or all these people influence your show. Well, for me, Mike Tyson, I saw him. He does a 90-minute one-man show that is absolutely phenomenal. And he's self-deprecating. He's funny. He's vulnerable. And literally, I mean, for the people that have seen his show, like, the guy's up there and he's making himself out to be like this scumbag, like beating up ladies, stealing things, just not caring. But at the same time, when somebody's vulnerable and honest, you start reflecting on yourself and you start looking at yourself in the mirror, realizing that I'm not perfect either. And you relate to him. And now you got the most feared man in the world. And I'm like, wait a minute, he's got issues too. Why can't I do this? I've been seeking out to try and accomplish this. Well, if Mike Tyson can do it, why can't I? And all of a sudden you start finding inspiration and motivation within the vulnerability. That's a powerful thing. And when I saw Mike Tyson, I said, you know what? I need to be more vulnerable in my own show. And I need to start sharing things so that the audience connects with me just like I'm connecting to him right now.
John Dorenbos, my guest. So you mentioned closure. The book ends with a chapter titled Closure. I don't want to give too much of this away, but what is that chapter about? And how did the events of that chapter come to be?
So the last chapter is the moment that I decide that it's time for me to go and sit and have lunch with my dad. And I remember growing up, my friends would say, hey, you want to go meet my dad and I for lunch? And I would always say yes, and I would try and meet them there because I wanted to walk in and I wanted to watch and see them sitting together as a father and son. And I had father figures in my life, but my biological dad obviously wasn't around. He was in prison. And so the final chapter is me kind of facing myself in the mirror saying, it's time to forgive and it's time to find motivation in this dysfunctional relationship that I had with my dad. In this horrible tragedy of him killing my mom, it's time to take this and find motivation to make myself a better father and to make myself a better husband. And I got to do it. So I went and I sat and I had a 5.5-hour lunch. I had lunch with my dad for the very first time. And I felt every emotion. It was super intense. And I took the road less traveled, I think. And I'm really glad I did it.
So forgiveness is a really powerful, really heavy concept. What then does it mean to you?
You know, forgiveness isn't about winning and losing. It's not about, I agree with what you did. It's not about keeping score. I realized that for me, I didn't need my dad's validation. I didn't need answers or excuses. I didn't need anything from him. I needed to be there for me. And I forgave him for me so that this cloud that was in my head of bitterness and anger and defeat, I can just let that go and actually be okay with my life, be okay with my past and say to myself, not everybody's perfect. We all have our issues and problems. In fact, that's life. The one thing that we can all relate to in life, I feel, is that moment when life's not going our way. It doesn't matter how much money you have or race, religion, or titles. It doesn't matter. One thing that we will always all relate to is the moment where life's ganging up on us and it's tackling us. But that moment that we stand up, that's what separates us. And I decide I'm going to live in vision. I'm not going to live in circumstance. I'm not going to make an excuse. And I'm going to live every day to try and bring pride back to my last name. So when people hear the name Dorenbos, they think of something great. They think of something positive. And not of my dad murdering my mom.
I love that, John. I'm going to live my life in vision and not in circumstance. Former NFL player, 14 years in the NFL, two-time Pro Bowler, a magician, and now an author who has written an amazingly powerful book. This book is called Life is Magic. It is out right now. John, congrats. I know I can't even begin to fathom what it must have been like to write that book, but you did it. You got it out there. It's amazing, and it's really good to have you back on the show. John, thanks so much.
I love you, man. Thank you.
Contractors everywhere can rely on Ferguson for a wide variety of specialty products, tools, supplies, and services. Thanks to their pro pickup service, you can shop online and pick up in store, leaving you with more time to focus on the work at hand. With more than 1,000 locations across the nation and expert associates ready to help with any job at all, you can trust that doing business with Ferguson will be the easiest part of your hard day of work. Visit Ferguson.com and find a location near you. Update on Cam Newton. The Panthers announced that he is going on IR. So that's going to end his season. And it also ends the debate over whether or not he will take over as the starting quarterback when he's healthy this season. That's going to end his season and effectively end his time in Carolina. I mean, bam! You can insert your overplayed line about life coming at you fast. But in the NFL, life comes at you with a 4-2-40. And then it hits you like a freight train. When it gets there. Because at this point, it would be more surprising if Cam Newton hadn't played his last down for Carolina than if he had. It would be more surprising if he was back next year with Carolina than if he wasn't. And if that feels kind of insane, think about this. Ever since he was drafted, he's been the face of that franchise. And now he's done for the year and probably done in Carolina, and he's 30. If we were to go back, and it feels like yesterday, it was 2015, we were to go back, he was Superman, the league MVP, leading the team to the Super Bowl. If we went back then, what would you have said if I told you he'd play only one more full season in Carolina? I mean, you wouldn't buy it because the guy seemed indestructible. You'd call me a liar. You'd call me an idiot or worse. And what if I told you that by November 2019, Cam Newton would be done in Carolina and Andrew Luck would be out of football altogether? Because that's exactly what happened. Two of the biggest, toughest, most physical quarterbacks you're ever going to see, but all the hits caught up with them both. Back in 2015, Cam Newton was 26, an MVP, had his team in the Super Bowl, and he was indestructible. He was the guy that you could not stop, the guy who would carve you up through the air, a guy who could run over you on the ground. And not just run over you, he could run through you, he could run around you, he could run away from you. And then drop the Superman reveal in the end zone. And that's when he was 26. Now he's 30. He's on injured reserve. And he's dealing with a second major injury in two seasons. And likely headed to a new team. In hindsight, maybe it was a mistake for Newton to fight through the shoulder pain last year. Maybe it was a mistake for him not to talk about the foot injury this year before he did. Maybe it was a mistake because he took so much crap from fans for fighting through both those injuries for Carolina. And now there's a good chance he's done there. He's got a year left on his contract, but he's also been hit more times than any other quarterback since 2011. He's had two shoulder surgeries and now a foot injury that cost him 14 games. And the Panthers would save more than $19 million by cutting him before next year. And Kyle Allen has played well. And the team's going to have to pay Christian McCaffrey and a bunch of starters on defense. In other words, there are so many reasons to cut this guy, so many more reasons to cut him than to keep him. And it is a business. And it can be a cruel, cold business in the end. That's pretty wild. 30 years old and done in Carolina. A former league MVP. And a guy who had Carolina in the Super Bowl. Done. And how weird will it be to see the Panthers without Cam Newton? And how much more weird will it be to see Cam Newton in a Chicago Bear uniform, for instance? And there is a lesson here, right? The same lesson that should have been learned with Andrew Luck. And that lesson is nobody is indestructible in that league. I don't care how big. I don't care how tough. I don't care how badly you want to be out there on the field for your teammates. I don't care what your pain threshold is or how much you're willing to sacrifice. This game comes for everybody at some point. So I'm looking at you, KC. I'm calling you out, Houston. I'm thinking of any team who thinks that they have their quarterback, their franchise quarterback, because not every team has one. Any team that thinks they have their guy, you better protect them. And you better protect them not only from the opponents, but from themselves. All the more reason why, if you're Kansas City, you better not rush Patrick Mahomes back. If you're Houston, the only thing that matters is keeping Deshaun Watson safe. If you've got a franchise quarterback, you have a chance. And you can have that chance for a decade or more if you take care of that guy. And if you take care of that guy, he'll take care of you. But if you keep rolling him out there to be a tackling dummy, it's going to end much earlier than you expect. Nobody is indestructible. Nothing is forever. Because Cam Newton looked indestructible. Same thing about Andrew Luck. And they're both done. Luck is out of football and Cam is out of Carolina. If you've got a franchise quarterback, you better take care of him. Have to take care of him. Man, he's going to look strange in somebody else's gear, especially in Chicago. You know who knew that Cam was going to dominate? when there might have been some skepticism? Bo Jackson came on this show prior to Cam playing his first down in the NFL. And Bo knew it. Bo called his shot.
When you speak of Cam Newton, he has the arm strength and power of Dan Marino and John Elway combined. He is quicker than Michael Vick, faster than Michael Vick. And he will run over you with the power of a Jerome Bettis, Bo Jackson, Earl Campbell. That's the type of guy he is. This guy's scary.
The thing is, I love a guy with a take. I love hyperbole. And, you know, I got so much respect for Bo Jackson. Bo Jackson, to me, is still, top to bottom, the greatest pure athlete I've ever spoken to in my life. Never seen anything like it. I mean, there were other two sports stars. Dion was an unbelievable two sports star. Brian Jordan was a two sports star. I've seen other freaky, freaky athletes that maybe start in one sport. I've never seen anything like Bo Jackson. I mean, Bo's the guy. Bo will always be the guy. So I hold him in such immense regard that I would never call Bo out. But I remember what I was thinking when Bo made those statements on this show. And what I was thinking was, and I could say it right now, easy, Bo. Easy. Arm strength of Elway and Marino combined. Faster than Michael Vick. Run you over like Jerome Bettis. Okay, Bo. And come to find out, Bo was right. And Bo called his shot. Man, Bo did know. Bo always knew. Herman Moore is my guest. Herman, great to have you on. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Thanks for having me.
It is great to have you and lots to talk about. Your former team, the Lions, are coming off a tough loss to Oakland. Let me start right there because they did start the year 2-0-1, but they've dropped three of their last four. So, Herman, eight games in, what kind of thoughts do you have about the team?
Well, right now the thoughts are really this is a team that's having some struggles. Offensively, they're trying to outscore their opponents, and I don't know if this team is good enough to do that on a consistent basis, definitely not week in and week out. They're going to need some help from a struggling defense that right now are not committing enough people to the pass rush because they're trying to protect the secondary. So there are some problems going into a critical part of the season. And right now we know that the month of November is where teams are deciding on their postseason opportunities and also whether or not they're going to have division titles.
Herman Moore joining us. You know, you also made the point on Twitter that the running game is going to be vital for the success of this team. You know, the way the game is played right now, it's pass first, pass, pass, pass. Lay it out for me. What do you mean by that? Why is the running game so critical to this crew?
Well, this is a team that has players that, especially when you look at the tight ends and then you look at a big play capability by the wide receivers, play action is big for them. They're able to, you know, draw up those secondary guys or be able to get them to have to commit out of the zone coverage or combo coverages into single coverage. Well, that's a tough task for a lot of these defensive backs against the likes of a Marvin Jones, or you start looking at a Kenny Golladay and even T.J. Hockenson. I mean, they're tough to manage that way. But if they can let guys play back and only have to rush a couple guys, then that becomes problematic because they have no fear of the run. And the only thing I would say is this, Jim, is that if you can't get the running game going, then perhaps you need to start implementing another receiver into the progression to where now they're looking to get that 3 to 5 yards and it becomes more of a read pattern.
Herman Moore is sounding like the four-time Pro Bowler he is, three-time All-Pro. He's working with Quick Lane Tire and Auto Center, and I'll pick that up a little bit later on. So, Herman, earlier this season, Matthew Stafford became the fastest player in league history to get to 40,000 passing yards. What do you make of that accomplishment and him as a quarterback? In other words, does he get the respect that he deserves?
I don't think necessarily he gets the respect he deserves nationally and league-wide. I think there's an appreciation, kind of bittersweet, even in the Michigan markets, because he's kind of grandfathered into some of the failures from the past. And that with that means that they're not as up on him and high on him as they really should be. He's a guy, they look at his win-loss record versus 500 or better teams. They look at the lack of the playoffs, performances and things of that nature, but he's been very durable. He's been very consistent, and he's been kind of the Iron Man of this position. And for Matthew Stafford, you look for that in a quarterback. Anytime you have a franchise that you can go with one guy for so long, there's something to be said about that. And I think there's many teams around the NFL who would love to have a player of his caliber that thinks that that's the missing piece. So, you know, does he get the recognition and the accolades that he deserves? Probably not. But does he need to also have some of those things like championships and division titles and also competing on the conference championship games? Absolutely. And I think short of that, he will never really hit that level other than being a guy that has a lot of stats.
We're talking to Herman Moore. Now, Herman, everybody knows how the game has changed in terms of what a defensive back and a linebacker can do. But for perspective, as a receiver, take everybody back to when you played. What was it like to try to get off the line of scrimmage, and what could DBs do to you back then?
That was a challenge in itself. You would always be worried or concerned a little bit about how would a team play you once you defeated that first defensive back. I knew that they would either walk up a safety and let the defensive back get really aggressive and then stack another guy behind them. Sometimes they bring up a linebacker, especially if you were a point in the slot position and we used to run a trip set out of the slot. That guy, you had no room. You can't really take a release inside. You really couldn't release outside because the linebackers were so strong and they were big and they would crowd the line. And within 5 yards back then, Jim, you know, it was everything goes. I mean, they could grab, they could hit. And if you ran that drag route and you weren't 5 yards deep and you had your head looking back at the quarterback, you could get wiped out on the other side and it wouldn't be illegal. The middle was open for your safeties. So it's changed quite a bit. And it was a challenge getting off the line, to say the least.
So if you get off the line, Herman, what was it like to run across the middle of the field in the NFC back in the day?
It was brutal because not only did you have to contend with safeties that were very aggressive, but you also had to deal with the implementation of Tony Dungy's Tampa 2. And you didn't know what linebacker was going to be running down and scouting you in the middle for one of those in routes. So you really had a couple layers there that you had to navigate that ultimately meant that if you did catch a pass, 9 times out of 10, you were going to get what we call blown up. You weren't necessarily just going to go through there and scape.
You had Tony Dungy's linebackers. Then you had John Lynch back there in the secondary, too.
A linebacker playing safety, absolutely. Number 47. And when you start remembering guys' numbers so easily, then you know.
That's such a great point. Like, Herman, what's another number? If I were to say to you, give me another number that comes to mind of a guy, like what other number or other numbers do you remember?
Steve Atwater.
Yep.
Carnell Lake. Even Ronnie Lott, near the end of his career, he was still moved over to safety. And Ronnie's one of those guys that sold out. You know, he would just come after you. He would come and blow the boom. So there were guys all across. Chuck Cecil, I ended up playing against him when he was out with the Houston Oilers near the end of his career, when he it was all about how many people could he knock out and knock himself out in the path of that.
So. Do you remember that, Herman? Like, well, I don't remember the exact caption, but Chuck Cecil was on the cover of SI that one year, right? Like the most dangerous man in the NFL. Atwater, too, especially. But then the amazing thing, Herman, you had 123 receptions in 1995. Given the way the game was officiated back then and the way we're talking about it, if you were allowed, or if you could play right now when defenses can no longer do these things, what kind of numbers would you put up when you consider the way the game is officiated now?
If I was still playing and then playing with a coordinator like Tom Moore, who you've seen what he's done everywhere he's gone, whether it's Arizona or Indianapolis, that was one that was geared towards guys that could get open, catch the ball, and make things happen. I think 150 for people in that system,
sure.
your top guy should average between 140, 150 a year in this climate, in this day and age.
Herman Moore, my guest. No, no doubt. So Saturday, let me ask you this. You, Lomas Brown, and a number of former Lions players accompanied a group of 79 veterans from World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, and you went to D.C. What was your reaction when that first came up, and then what was that trip like?
You know, words really can't do it any justice, and I didn't know what to expect when I was asked to be one of the guardians that would go out with these military veterans and to tour D.C. and to see just these monuments and the memorials and all these things that would bring back so many memories. it was fun the first night because these guys got a chance to meet one another. They were from all different places around the country and different branches of the military. And then the next day when we got out to D.C., it was just quiet on the bus. And you look at them looking around. And then when we got to go to the different sites, whether it was, you know, for Vietnam or Korea or World War II, it was surreal because you realize the sacrifices and the unselfishness that these guys have made to protect people they don't even know and they may never even meet. That's an ultimate sacrifice. So it was an honor for me to be there with them and to support them and take them around. And I hope I get invited to do it again.
What an amazing experience. NFL great Herman Moore, my guest. You're working with Quick Lane Tire and Auto Center. Herman, what are you doing with them?
Well, with Quick Lane Tire and Auto Center, I have a trading one uniform for another program, which awards $10,000 scholarships to military veterans. But also they've opened it up so that you can also include our first responders. Nominations have started for that scholarship, and we know Veterans Day is coming up on Monday, so we tell you to keep them in mind, not just then, but going through, if you know of someone, to nominate them. You have until December 6th to do so, and then we're going to announce the winners on December 26th at the Quick Lane Bowl. And for those who don't know about Quick Lane has been a title sponsor for the past 6 years and also over 800 locations across the country. So this is a wonderful, wonderful company and organization that's made a commitment back to those that are so deserving.
Very, very good cause. Glad to talk about it. Herman, one last thought. You had a tweet and you had this picture of you in the weight room and a great caption, quote, "Getting it in. I take my mental and physical health seriously. 30 pounds kicking my butt doing high reps. Plus, I don't want to look like I never played the game." Man, I love that attitude. When you work as hard as you did during your career, it would be easy and tempting to kind of let yourself go in retirement like you earned it, but you haven't done that. How come?
Because one thing, my family, my wife, she does a lot of personal training, but she's also in the mental and physical health space. So going out and making sure that I take care of myself and set the example for my two sons, they're 26 and 27. If you want longevity in life, you got to take care of yourself. This is the only vehicle we got that's going to carry us the rest of the way. So we got to take care of it, not just on the physical, but the mental side as well.
He retired as the Lions team leader in career receptions, receiving yardage and TD catches, 12 years in the NFL, four-time Pro Bowler, and today appearing compliments of Quick Lane Tire and Auto Center. Herman, great to get caught up. I appreciate it so much. Great to have you back.
Hey, Jim, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Good night now!